Okay, continuation of Preserving ISKCON. All right, so we're going on with Stark's list from research. The next way that a religion is likely to grow and maintain is if it has many highly highly motivated preachers, because they're going to go out and preach, and then more people will join. And another thing is many enthusiastic volunteers. Volunteers can substitute for money. You know, it's one of the interesting things that I've been meditating on is how we will often give more status to donors than to volunteers. But there really isn't any difference. If I go out at a job and I make 30 euros an hour and I donate 30 euros, I've donated that hour of my time. And if I normally get paid 30 euros an hour and I work at the temple for an hour, I've donated 30 euros. In fact, I might have donated more than that, because if I've done work at the temple that you'd have to pay 50 euros for somebody else to do, that I might have donated more than 30 euros. Yeah.
And it's spiritually beneficial for the person. Because otherwise you might just think that, let me get the money and work outside. But for the person itself, better.
Well, it's very, I think it also can be as spiritually beneficial to donate your money as to donate your time. But what's nice about donating your time is you get to be with the other devotees. You get it's easier to feel that you're part of the mission. It's a little easier. I mean, you certainly can get the same spiritual and psychological benefit from donating your money. If when you're working at the job, if the whole time you're working, you think, this hour I'm giving you to you, Krishna. You know, everything I'm doing for this hour, this is going to you. It would be the same thing.
Sometimes donations are not so much hard work. It's just like, They're lucky because they somehow have some heritage. And
that's also true.
And it's a big difference.
But it's interesting that we generally give more status to donors than to volunteers. I think it's very interesting that we generally give more status to donors than to volunteers. I mean, of course, one of the benefits if you're a temple leader or a project leader is if people give you money, then you can decide how you want to spend it. And if they give you volunteer work, they're pretty much deciding, you know, okay, I'm willing to do this, but I'm not willing to do that. Unless people give money for a specific purpose. If they say, okay, I'm giving money just for this purpose, and you can't spend it on anything else. But a lot of what makes a religious organization thrive and grow is having an army of volunteers. And the temples that really have a lot of volunteers are very successful. I mean, that's one of the great wealth of London. The number of volunteers that are associated with Bhaktivedanta Manor is just amazing. And also with Utah, the number of volunteers that are involved. And conversely, there's a lot of temples in the world where nobody volunteers. You know, the place is falling apart, it's dirty, nothing's taken care of, and nobody wants to volunteer. I once visited there was a temple that I was visiting regularly for some family reasons, because I had some family in the area. And it had at one point been a very vibrant temple. Lots of people coming, lots of people from all different nationalities and races and ages. There were a lot of seminars going on. It was a very live temple. And then all of a sudden I went there and it was dead. It was just dead. The deities were starting to get dressed once a week. I was the only one at Mangal Arati when I stayed at the temple. I was the only one, me and the pujari. And I would sit down in the temple to chant japa, and the pujari went and turned off all the lights and turned on a tape of a shanai. So I turned off the tape and turned on the lights, and he turned them back on. I went out about three times, and I said, okay, I'm not chanting in the temple room. I gave class there. Three people came to class. I was there for a major festival. There were 600 people. They were all Indian. This was in the West. And I was told later they were all from only two families. There were five of us who were Western. Out of 600 people. And nothing was getting done. And I asked one of the devotees there, I said, what's happened in this place? And she said, well, the former temple president wasn't very good with money. She said he was getting the temple into debt and spending too much money, so we got rid of him. We got this guy who's really careful with money. But his wife just blows at everybody. Whoever comes, she yells at them and criticizes them, so nobody wants to come here and do any service. I said, you should have kept your old town president and gotten a new treasurer. Anyway, what I saw is because they had somebody who didn't make people feel welcome, nobody wanted to volunteer. Now, I haven't been to Houston, Texas. What I've heard is that the temples run 100% by volunteers. That's what I've heard. I've heard that they have no full-time anybody. They don't have a full-time temple president. You know, most temples, there's people who are full-time maintained by the temple. But what I've heard, again, I haven't been there. I don't know firsthand.
It's huge.
Is that, have you been there?
Huge.
And that basically the community does everything. The community has a rotating basis on which they do all the deity worship and all the management. And frankly, when I was brought up in a Jewish family, other than the rabbi and maybe the janitor, everybody was like, my father was the temple president, and he was also the president, he was the CEO, actually, of a huge multinational corporation. He was also the local temple president. He did it on a part-time volunteer basis. So that's another model. But the more that you have volunteers, you generate a mood of enthusiasm. I mean, one of the most exciting things with this book project we just finished was just all the volunteers that were working on it. Altogether, about 200 people volunteered their time and effort. And the amount of enthusiasm and energy that was generated from that was amazing. You know, you really felt like you were part of a team. So these are two other things, missionaries and volunteers, that are essential to keep a religious organization vital and growing. Okay, next thing is babies.
Nice. And
this isn't, do you know anybody in this family? It's a very nice family. He's a scholar. I can't remember his name. Her name is Sambit.
From which country?
I don't know.
Yeah.
You want to have 10 kids?
Cool.
I was just actually Radhika Raman told me that when he got married his wife told him in India, he married an Indian girl in India, she said, I want to have 15 children. And after she moved to America, she said, I think I only want to have 3. She said, it's so hard to take care of kids in the West. She said, you know, in India someone else just picks up, like what you're doing with my laundry, you just pick it up, of course you don't fold it and put it away. She said, Andy, you know, people just take your laundry and they just wash it for you and they hang it up for you and then they iron it for you and then they fold it up and then they put it away. She said, but here in America, I've got to take the laundry, I've got to sort it out, I've got to put it in the machine, I've got to take it out of the machine, I've got to put it in the dryer, I've got to sort it out, I've got to fold it up, I've got to put it away. She says, I work so much harder to do household chores with these machines than I work in India with servants. So it was very interesting. One of our biggest problems as far as the long-term vitality of our movement is that we do not value babies in ISKCON. And I personally see it as a major, major problem. People are marrying late, a lot of couples don't have any children, and there are certain places you go where that's the average, where the average couple has 0 children, practically speaking, you know. They look around, nobody has kids. And then if people do have kids, they usually only have 1 or 2, maybe 3 maximum. Having more than 3 children in ISKCON is pretty unusual. And the problems with that is, remember when we talked about people from alien cultures? This means that the vast majority of our members are coming from alien cultures. Frankly, even if they're Indian, ISKCON is its own culture. I mean, unless they're coming from Gaudiya Vaishnava backgrounds in India, unless they're like Bengalis coming from Gaudiya Vaishnava backgrounds, or they're people from Vrindavan. You know, basically, most of our members are bringing alien cultures into ISKCON. If we think that it's important, and maybe we don't think it's important, Nanda Maharaj doesn't think it's important, but if we think it's important, and I personally think it's important, that we're not only supposed to be developing a religion, but we're also supposed to be developing a culture. I don't see how we're going to do it if we just keep pulling in people from alien cultures as our main population. They're bringing their stuff in with them. They're bringing their outside culture in with them. They're bringing their cultural concepts with them. And what I see is that people brought up in the movement they're much more spiritually mature. So you have somebody who's 20 years old and who's a 20-year devotee. You know, if you join at 20, you're not a 20-year devotee until you're 40. By the time you're a mature devotee, you're old. and you can't run around as a fired up preacher doing things anymore. So if you have all converts and all the people running around with that youthful energy are all a bunch of flaming fanatics, you know, and people who are unbalanced and people who've put their own cultural capital into cold storage and don't know how to use it in Krishna's service and don't have any deep understanding of the philosophy. So your most enthusiastic frontline people are not your most highly qualified people if you've got a religion of mostly converts.
Would the coolies fit that picture?
Well, they should.
Oh, I mean, the picture.
Well,
this small picture.
And what fit what picture?
This small picture of your painting of.
Well, we're going to come to our number 10. We're going to deal with some other things with the youth. But first of all, you've got to have youth. You've got to be producing children in your own organization who are brought up with that culture.
In Islam, we don't produce as many kids as we are.
No, we don't produce very many at all, no. We still have a very anti-householder, anti-children culture in Islam.
There's lots of kuli and kuli melas.
Not in proportion to the amount of converts. Oh, no.
It's funny because Gurukuli kids now that are married are tend to be the ones that actually do have a lot of kids.
Because they're products of our own culture.
They have a lot.
Well, that's because they're products of our own culture. Mm.
And they came from small families.
Well, that's another reason. But also their project, well, you're not from a small family.
That's why I don't want a big family.
Well, it's interesting. You know, my son and his wife have 7 kids. And most of those kids want to have big families of their own. One or two of them don't, but most of them want to. Plus, you didn't have a father there all the time. But what we see is that people brought up in the culture think very differently. They definitely think very differently. Of course, not all of our kids are brought up in the culture. That we'll get to with that. But if we really want to establish our own culture, if the vast majority of our members are coming from alien cultures, it's going to take us billions of years to establish a new culture because we have to re-educate all these people in what is our own native culture. We've got to give them a whole education, and we never really get it. Us converts never really get it. We always stay somewhat in our alien culture. And then the other thing is it takes us a long time to become spiritually mature, especially if you come from a meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, you know, Darwin culture. It takes a long, long, long time to become spiritually mature. It doesn't happen very fast for most of us. And I've seen the kids brought up in Krishna consciousness are spiritually mature by the time they're, you know, 15, 20 years old, or they can be. And, you know, there really has not been a religious organization that was stable and grew without having a reasonable fertility rate. It hasn't happened in world history. It just hasn't happened. Prabhupada was once asked, how will the movement go on when you're gone? He said, we have our school in Dallas. Well, we're now preaching this in ISKCON. The way ISKCON's going to go on is through our children. Who talks like this? A few people. Not many. Not many. Most of our leaders don't encourage children at all. There is basically nothing going on in our movement in terms of leadership as far as educational programs for our children or anything for our children, facility for our children, you know. In Prabhupada's Centennial Lotus, there was no lotus petal for education. You saw the Centennial Lotus, all the things ISKCON does. Or the North American GBC, when they did their strategic planning, they decided there were 17 services that ISKCON offers, and none of them were, there was nothing there about children's education. And I went to my local GBC and I said, where's education for children? He said, oh, that's included in community outreach. I said, right, Maharaj. I said, I don't believe that. Do you believe that? He said, no, but that's what we're supposed to say if anybody asks. This year, finally, an education committee was added to the GBC. They had committees for strategic planning, they had committees for devotee care, they have committee for this and committee for that. Finally, we got an education committee, which has not met or had any kind of communication or done diddly spot. I think that's like in the first one. Okay, this Stark considers to be the least important, that a religion is likely to flourish where other religions are not strong and where the government gives freedom to the new religions. So he makes a point that I think is very valid. He said that generally, if people are already committed to a religion, they're not likely to convert, if they're strongly committed. And we see this also. We see the number of people who become devotees who are really strongly committed to another religion previously is very small. That generally, people will come if they're only slightly committed. And two reasons for that. First of all, they're already getting what they need from a religious organization. And second of all, they don't want to give up their cultural capital if they've really amassed a lot of cultural capital, or you could say religious capital, in the other religion. You know, at this point in my life, even if I decided that Islam was a better religion, you know, I've really worked hard at being a Hare Krishna devotee. Do I really want to give that up and become a Muslim? Do you understand what I'm saying? Would I want to start all over again? So one Guru Kuli that I know very well was dating a Jewish girl for a while. And she took him to her house, and they were, you know, saying all the prayers. And he said to me, he said, well, I like this girl. He said, but I spent my life learning Sanskrit. I don't really want to learn Hebrew now. So he was basically saying this thing that Stark's saying. I don't want to throw away all my cultural capital and have to learn a whole other set of cultural capital to join this other religion. It's not worth it to me. Okay, here's his next point, that religions that prosper and grow are ones that have strong internal ties with a flexible organizational structure. So, in other words, that people within the society like each other and they're friends with each other and they get along. This is one of the main things the Amish have. And here I have one of my few quotes from Prabhupada in this. That the International Society for Krishna Consciousness has been established to facilitate these six kinds of loving exchanges between the devotees. So people are likely to stay in an organization if there's a... what kind of culture? A clan culture. Are people likely to stay in a religious organization with a bureaucratic culture? Mm-hmm. No. Are they likely to tell other people to join a religion with a...
Exchanges if it's bureaucratic.
It'd be pretty difficult now, wouldn't it?
You can buy it all in the same shop.
You have to look up in the company rule book as to when you can celebrate birthdays, you know. So it's interesting. I was just reading another quote from Prabhupada today, which I didn't have time to put in this presentation, where he said our society should be like a family. He actually said that. He said this kind should be like a family, or based on love and trust.
My family, we have to buy the family shop.
You have to buy the family shop. There you go. Okay. You have to follow the norms. Anyway, so you're likely to want to bring people into the religious organization. A question I get asked a lot is, what do I do if I don't feel like telling people to join the temple that I live in? And God, I was in that situation for a long time in various temples, where I would preach to people to become Krishna conscious, but then I think about, do I really want to tell them to move into the ashram here? And I think, well, no, not really. And someone asked me this recently, not here. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I very rarely preach to people to move into any ashram anymore. I said, I preach people to join ISKCON, and I preach to them to take up Krishna consciousness. I said, but I mostly discourage people from joining ashrams. It's rarely that I'll encourage somebody to join an ashram. So if we really felt that there was a temple that had a family atmosphere, then we'd be much more likely to say, hey, you know, you should join. But he's saying that not closed. Not that you have such a family atmosphere and you've got a closed organization. He said, if you've got a closed organization, then you're going to suffocate, right? And you read about the summary of White, what happens to closed organizations. He said you've got to maintain social ties. Now here he says something that I disagree with. He says that people don't join a religious organization because they agree with the doctrine, but because they have friends inside the organization. Well, you know, I didn't know anybody in ISKCON. I wasn't friends with anybody in ISKCON. That wasn't why I joined ISKCON. I joined ISKCON because I agreed with the doctrine. And that's what I've seen for at least when I joined, at least the 70s. 60s and 70s, I saw that people joined ISKCON because they agreed with the doctrine, not because I had some friend who was a devotee. But that also certainly works. I mean, when you make friends at work or at school or in social networks that are not part of ISKCON, some of those people may become devotees, or they may join the organization. That especially works with the Indians. So, I hope you don't mind I put in that picture that includes me there. It was all I had handy, and I was putting this together fast. So that you should have, your close friends should be other members. Yeah, that's me, that's my husband, that's my oldest son, Rory, and that's my daughter, Temperman. It's funny how some people in that picture aren't living anymore. Sunita's not living anymore. Sanjaya's not living anymore. Just recently saw Purusharta and his wife in Hungary. Time is interesting. Anyway, so he's saying that religious organizations that do well are ones where members have very close ties with each other, that they have intimate friends among the other members, but they also keep relationships with outsiders. They don't cut off all their relationships with outsiders. In the beginning days of ISKCON, we cut off all of our relationships with outsiders, even our mommy and daddy. Then, not only we talked about that the religion itself, and I hope you can make this distinction, that the religion itself has to have enough strictness to keep member commitment and identity, but not so strict that all you have are a few fanatics. And then this is another area. It's got to keep that. It's got to keep that. It's got to have it. It's one area. It's got to have it to start with. Another area, it's got to keep it. They've got to remain sufficiently strict. Now, again, not so strict that you only have some fanatics. And again, you have this tension with people who want to keep their cultural capital and they don't want something that's too radically different from the outside culture. And we see this as ISKCON has grown, haven't it? Haven't we? In the beginning, people were willing to be radically different from the outside culture. And I see that not very many devotees are willing to do that anymore.
That was adolescent.
Very much so. I see that the majority of devotees are not willing to be weirdos in the outside culture anymore. They're not willing to pay that price on a daily basis. Anyway, have to be able to remain strict. And I really like what he said, keep both the front door and the back door open. That the only way you're going to remain strict is like that picture? The only way you're going to remain strict is not only are you bringing in a lot of new people, but if somebody doesn't want to follow, let them leave. Don't try to keep people who don't want to follow. That if you start having a lot of people who don't want to be strict, they'll be free riders. Free riders are people putting water into that juice jug. And then pretty soon all anybody gets to drink is water. The whole organization becomes watered down as we get the watered down idea. So to keep strictness, see a high rate of defection is a good thing. Don't think, oh, it's so terrible if people leave. Think if people leave, or what we would prefer is that people don't leave entirely, but that they kind of step out of the core if they don't want the strictness, that they move more to a peripheral position. And see, this is a good thing, that if someone says, hey, you know, I want to take some intoxication, or I want to go to the movies, and we say, all right, fine, you can still chant Hare Krishna, and you can be a general member of ISKCON, but, you know, we can't be a core member, then that's a very good thing. It's going to keep the vitality of the organization. And same for new converts. So he's making the point that for kids born in the movement, he's making the point that for converts, people select an organization because they're already attracted to the level of strictness. So if people don't want to be strict, they're not going to join in the first place. But kids who are born into the organization, they're not making that selection. And so they're not going to necessarily have the same thing, oh, I want the same level of strictness. So also let those who are born leave if they don't want that area of strictness. Now, I've seen something that he doesn't mention, since I've worked so much with kids, is that when a person converts to ISKCON, especially if we say you have to give up your cultural capital and you have to adopt a radically different culture, not just a different philosophy, that it involves a certain amount of fanaticism in the beginning. Almost has to. You almost have to involve a certain kind of fanaticism in order to say, okay, I'm going to just put all my cultural capital in cold storage. You don't say that. You say, I'm going to throw it all away. You don't actually throw it away. It's what you're saying. You're saying, I'm going to throw all my cultural capital away. I'm going to adopt not only a new religion, a new philosophy, I'm going to adopt an entirely new culture. Whoa. In order to do that, you've got to be a little nuts. You've got to be a little off balance. You have to be. You can't really do that and be a very emotionally or spiritually balanced person. And you have to think that you're a lot more elevated than you are. You know, because if you realize where you're at, you could see that you really can't do what you're trying to do. But, you know, you have to believe that you can do something. You're not really doing it. But you've got to believe that you're really doing it, and you've got to believe that you're really capable of doing it, which is what Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur calls false confidence. And, of course, if you stay in that position, it's just miserable. It's miserable for you, and it's miserable for everybody who has to deal with you. But you do go through this, and then you gradually, hopefully, it doesn't always happen, but you gradually come to maturity and balance. Gradually. Some people don't. Some people stay in that place for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Hare Krishna. What I've seen is that kids born in the movement, if they are trained nicely, don't go through that. They just don't. They've been integrating Krishna consciousness with their culture from day one. They never have to throw out their culture. And they just don't have to do it. They don't have to say, everything I've learned is Maya, let me throw it in the trash. They don't have to be a fanatic, ever. If they're raised nicely. If kids brought up in the movement are not raised nicely, they may have to also go through the conversion process to a greater or lesser extent.
At the same time, because they, of their youthfulness, then they have to be protected by that and keep a certain amount of restrictions.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so his last point, this is point number 10, is for religions to prosper and thrive, you have to socialize those born in the movement to minimize two things, because it's no good if you have a whole lot of babies and they all leave. That's no use. So you want to not only have a lot of babies, but you want most of them to want to be members of the organization. And you also want them to not have this urge for reduced strictness. Because if you're born in the organization, you don't have the same feeling of fanaticism that the new converts have. Yes, I've chosen to devote my life to God. This happens not just in ISKCON. You know what happens in any religious organization. I've chosen to devote my life to God. I'm throwing out everything I've done in the past, and I'm just going to devote my life to God, and I'm going to be a pure devotee now. You know, and those born in the movement, like I say, unless they're not raised nicely, unless they're raised with a lot of materialism, they don't go through that. They just don't. The only ones I've seen go through that are the ones whose parents were in Maya, or the kids got into a lot of Maya and then they came back. But the kids who never got into a lot of Maya, they don't go through that. So the tendency for those kids who were never in a lot of Maya was they don't go through the fanatic thing. And therefore they have a tendency to not be so strict. They have a tendency to think, like Indians think, that, well, I'm already a devotee. Because it's true. They are already a devotee. They have a tendency to think, oh, I already see Krishna in everything. I already relate to Krishna. I already think of, you know, yum, this is good. Yum, yum, bhisvaram, bhavam. I already think of Bhagavad Gita verses all the time when I hear things. I already think of Krishna pastimes all the time. Like, you know, even if I'm out drinking beer and smoking marijuana, I'm thinking about Krishna. And you know what? It's true. It's actually true. So it's very common for those people to think, okay, I don't need to be so strict. Why do I need to be so strict? And then they look at, you know, their parents or the converts who were really strict and really were really fanatics and couldn't maintain it. And they think, where's that at? And then they also looked at the strict fanatics who were mean to everybody and say, where's that at? You know, I don't want to be like that. So there's a strong tendency for those born in the movement not to be so strict, which of course is dumb because then you'll have to get them at birth. But that's another thing. So there's a tendency for them either just to leave entirely. They say, well, I didn't choose this. This isn't what I want. Maybe this is what my parents want, but this is not what I want. Or to just say, well, yeah, I want to still be a member, but I don't want to be so strict. So for a movement to maintain and to grow, it has to socialize its youth. And I just love what he says how to do this. I often preach about how to give our kids the culture of Krishna consciousness. Now, he only focuses here on one thing. He says, each successful movement for which data exists, in other words, there are some successful religions for which there's no data, finds important things for young people to do on behalf of their faith, ways in which youth can exhibit and build commitment. Hence, movements get more from their young people to the extent that they ask more from them. This is the same principle of volunteering in general. That when you have when you demand a higher level of commitment, and everyone gives a higher level of commitment, everyone gets back more than they've put in. It's exactly like a potluck feast. You've all gone to a potluck feast where everybody brings a prep?
Yeah.
Have you all been to that?
I think they don't use the word potluck.
What do you use here? Whatever it is. You've all been to a feast, I assume. In some places in America, we do this is our regular way we do feasts, is everybody brings a prep. And you know what? You always get back more than you put in. You always, right? I mean, there's so many preparations and there's so much prasadam at those things that you can't possibly eat everything. And when you demand high commitment, you get back more than you put in. And when you do that of the youth, then they're part of the organization. Of course, this is what Prabhupada also said to do. And I would like to submit, I don't think it's the only important way to socialize the youth. I'd say there's other important, very important things also. But right now, we're just going to concentrate on this. That in other words, you give people, my suggestion to parents is, I say preferably by age 11 and definitely by age 14, that kids should be doing meaningful adult-level work in ISKCON. Meaningful adult-level work. By 11 and definitely by 14. My suggestion is by 11 and for sure by 14. Some work where it, maybe their parents can't treat them as adults. It's very hard for parents to treat kids as adults even when they're 40. One time my son-in-law was saying to me, he said, "Mother, why can't you treat my wife as your peer?" I said, "Look, she's my daughter." I said, "She's going to be my daughter for this life." And I said, "She's my friend, but she's also my daughter. I'm never going to be able to treat her totally as an equal. It just isn't going to happen." So that's just the way it is. So with parents and their children, you know, you may never be able to, the parents may not always be the ones who are the best people to engage their children, is my point. It may have to be other adults in the community. But if someone's doing adult-level work, I mean, just like my 13-year-old grandson made the video to promote my books. It's a professional level video. It's not perfect. Some of the sound's a little scratchy. It's a professional level video. People are appreciating it. They don't even know who made it. They're appreciating it as adult work. When he was 6, he was writing plays that were being performed in the temple. You know, when you've got kids who are they're designing leaflets, they're working in the garden. I was at one temple in Puerto Rico where the kids went to outside schools. They weren't very strict, but the temple president engaged them in managing all the gardens. It was really interesting. I mean, he gave them the responsibility. They cut the lawn, they took care of the flowers, they took care of the veggies, and they took it as their responsibility. They were about 14 or 16. And they were so enlivened to be part of ISKCON. It was interesting. It was really interesting. I mean, they weren't that strict. And one of the girls, I'd see her at the mall in a miniskirt and stuff. But they really wanted to be part of ISKCON. They really felt like they were a part of ISKCON and ISKCON was their organization. Why? Because they were making a meaningful contribution to it. It wasn't just somebody saying, "You're part of ISKCON, you're part of ISKCON." And people treated them like adults. They valued them like adults. What does the kid want to do most is when it wants to be an adult. That's what a kid wants more than anything else. They want to be an adult. Right? So just let's go through our summary. There's a reason why I picked Balaram, and if you can figure it out, we'll see. If I don't know if I have any prize to give you. But. Okay, let's just look at the conclusion here. I think he's in from Hungary. He's not generally worshipped. Well, also, I was thinking about stability. Thinking about religious stability. And Balaram's the original guru. So for stability, you have to have the parampara. And also of the Ladidi Sambit and Sandini potency, Balaram is in charge of the Sandini potency. The Sandini potency is that of maintenance. Sandini is the land of the spiritual world, the chairs, the houses, stability. So therefore I put Balaram there. So if we just go through the conclusions, which is the very end of Rudyard Stark's article. Okay? Religious movements will succeed to the degree that they retain cultural continuity with the conventional face of the society within which they seek converts. Their doctrines are non-empirical. Page 268, right here. Their doctrines are non-empirical. They maintain a medium level of tension with their surrounding environment, are strict but not too strict. They have legitimate leaders with adequate authority, which means there's clear doctrinal justification for an effective and legitimate leadership. An authority is regarded as more legitimate and gains in effectiveness to the degree that members perceive themselves as participants in the system of authority. They can generate a highly motivated volunteer religious labor force, including many willing to proselytize. They maintain a level of fertility sufficient to at least offset member mortality. They compete against weak local conventional religious organizations within a relatively unregulated religious economy. They sustain strong internal attachments while remaining an open social network, able to maintain and form ties to outsiders. They continue to maintain sufficient tension with their environment, remain sufficiently strict over time. They socialize the young sufficiently well as to minimize both defection and the appeal of reduced strictness. So from a sociological, empirical, research perspective, if we look at what religious societies have grown, have stayed over the centuries, they've done most of these 10 things. And then if we looked at Fink's perspective, he said that for a religious society to maintain itself and to prosper, it has to keep the core principles and be willing to innovate in other areas. So we've had a lovely 9 days.
Good God.
I hope that you learned something. I hope that
you've
enjoyed yourself.